Hi, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, you can hear that we have a very special guest host, Varsha.
Woo! Hi, everybody.
I'm doing a happy dance. I talk about Varsha all the time because she's the best and I love her. And we are so excited to get to actually do an episode together.
I'm very excited as well. I've been listening to you guys since you started way back in 2017 late 2016. And it was a salvo for me. And I'm very, very happy that I am here now.
Yeah, we're so, so happy that you are with us as well. So we have a pretty dense and packed show today. First, we are going to talk about the Title X funding, the global gag rule, the domestic gag rule, and how the Trump administration is fucking us all over this time. It is just like a swan song of everything the far right wants out of a president. So really gross stuff.
Yeah, it's very depressing, really gross stuff, but it sort of is extremely on brand for Hellbent.
Oh, it's so on brand. We are going to also talk about another school shooting. This one was in Texas. And again, it was because some personification of male tears felt like he was denied access to sex or romance or the woman that he wanted to be with. And so he got a hold of a gun, which you can do in this country, and then perpetrated, what is it, the 16th mass school shooting in 2018?
And what's really frustrating with this one is that I think he got the guns from his parents. They were registered to his parents. Mm. So it's just a very depressing story. But more than how he got the gun, what's more depressing with this one is we're seeing a pattern about how this is also about violence against women. So it's a double whammy.
So before we get started, Varsha, how was your weekend? It's Sunday night. We're recording on Sunday night because Varsha is doing research at the Reagan Library. But yeah, have you done anything fun?
Yeah. So my whole past week, Monday through Friday, was at the Reagan Library. I actually came across a couple documents about the original global gag rule, which was pretty depressing. But then on Saturday, I went to the museum and library of another disgraceful president, Richard Milhouse Nixon, which was actually pretty awesome. One thing that we're going to learn today is that Title X funding was actually signed into legislation by Richard Nixon and lobbied for by George H.W. Bush. So not all Republicans are jackasses every single day.
Well, it's so funny because Sarah and I used to experiment with recording on Sundays because, you know, it's like, hey, we'll get the episode out earlier, all this stuff. And I remembered why we don't do it. It's because my life is always a hot mess on Sundays. And today, yeah. And today I was the gym that Alex and I go to, Nerdstrong. They have their own podcast because it's in the name Nerdstrong. So it's a bunch of nerds. And so they have their own podcast. And so they had me on as a guest. And that should be coming out later this week.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So Alex and I are both on and we talk about like working out while we have a kid and like the changes that we've done and like what we nerd out about. And spoiler alert, I nerd out about politics. So
yeah, I only have three things I nerd about: politics, history, and Harry Potter. And ooh, luckily I have Harry podcasts Potter for all three of them.
Exactly. All right, Hellions, I'm going to make a confession again. I record most of these shows in my PJs, and it's actually one of the main perks of working from home. So when I learned about Tommy John, a revolutionary men's underwear company, was launching a women's line, I was actually really excited. Their underwear and camis are so soft and comfortable that I have replaced almost all of my underwear with their new women's gear, and their t-shirts and PJ pants are my go-to for recording days. Aren't you so happy you know this much about me now, Hellions? Tommy John, quality fabrics, and innovative and intuitive designs are a testament to their commitment to providing mind-blowing comfort. They are so comfortable. I feel like I cannot describe how happy this makes me. And they also have the best pair you'll ever wear or it's free guarantee. If Tommy John isn't the most comfortable underwear you've ever worn, Tommy John will pick up the tab. They've sold more than 5 million pairs of underwear. That's a lot of undies. And I'm really hoping that Paul Manafort knows about them because you know he's going to need some new underwear after shitting his pants. We didn't get to talk about it, but Robert Mueller has him pinned. So hurry to TommyJohn.com/hellbent for 20% off your first order. That's TommyJohn.com/hellbent for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/hellbend. Your butt will thank you. All right, Varsho, let's jump right in. We've got so much to talk about. So since you brought it up and since you saw something about it in the course of your research, can you tell us a little bit about Title X funding, the global gag rule, and what the fuck the Trump administration is doing with both of those things?
Yeah. So basically, Richard Nixon in 1970 signed into law Title X, and it's basically the only funding stream that's dedicated solely to family planning services. And basically, it means that after it was signed into law in 1970, a bunch of poor people and mainly poor women got access to family planning services. And it was really, really important. And then recently, since 1970, obviously, those level of services have increased. For example, Planned Parenthood not just offers family planning, but also contraceptive care, STI screenings, pap smear, cancer screenings. And it's really essential because it makes sure that, people of women, poor women, women of color who don't have insurance have access to this kind of healthcare. And it's really essential. But this new domestic gag rule, which actually was tried under another esteemed president, Ronald Reagan, is something that Donald Trump is trying to try. It's something that the evangelical right has been gunning for since 1988 when Ronald Reagan first tried it. So
what is a gag rule? What does that mean?
Yeah. So basically it says that any clinics that provide abortion services or refer patients to places that would do abortion services are going to lose federal funding under this new rule. And it's similar to the one that Ronald Reagan signed in, which said that abortion services have to have a physical separation and totally separate personnel from other family planning activities. Or if you don't do that, then you can't get any federal funding. And it's also a gag rule because it says that caregivers could not even talk about abortion, could not even refer people to abortion. And so this initial one that Reagan passed was struck down and then upheld, but then it was ultimately struck down by Bill Clinton when he became president. So it never really went into effect, but finally Trump has brought it back.
I spoke with Hellbent's favorite lawyer, Aditi, a little bit about this. And so I recorded a little bit with her that I'll chop in here about the legal side of this and sort of the uphill legal battle this kind of gag rule might be facing, which was a very interesting conversation. So I have the pleasure to sit down with fellow Hellion, Aditi Juneja, and get her legal opinion on what is going on with the gag rule. So thank you for taking a few minutes to walk us through this, Aditi.
Yeah, sure, totally.
So can you explain what the gag rule is?
Yeah, so the gag rule basically further restricts the use of federal funds. So the Hyde Amendment already restricts that federal funds can't be used to fund abortions. But the gag rule basically says that federal funds can't be given to healthcare providers who talk about or counsel patients on abortions.
Right. And it's pretty much every Republican president has instated some version of the gag rule as soon as they come into office. But Trump has done that and expanded it in some ways. So can you explain that?
Yeah, it's actually not my understanding that every Republican president has instated the gag rule. Most have done a global gag rule. They've done it internationally with where we give foreign aid. But I believe Ronald Reagan was the last president to do it domestically.
Oh, okay. Okay. So the gag rule that is instated and is talked about is a global gag rule and is not domestic. I see.
Yeah, actually, we rarely talk about a domestic gag rule. When people talk about the gag rule, they're usually talking about it internationally.
Yes, I guess that's my understanding. When I hear the gag rule, I think about the international gag rule that gets basically turned on and off depending on the president.
That's right.
So what is the Trump administration attempting to do with this gag rule?
So, well, I guess it's first important to say that the president cannot unilaterally implement a gag rule. It has to go through like any other rule. It has to go through notice and comment. So HHS would basically propose a rule, and which it has not done yet, as far as I know, which then goes through a period of notice and comment where they are required to kind of consider comment of people experts, citizens. There's, you know, the Federal Register's online. So like we could all go online and comment on the gag rule when it's proposed and say that we don't like it. And then basically they would be trying to limit the ability of places to get federal funding, places that discuss abortion, which is, you know, most medical providers, from getting access to funds.
I mean, as abortion is a legal medical procedure, it would make sense that medical facilities would discuss them because it is like getting any other medical procedure. So yeah. I have a question. If you know, with the notice and comment period, you know, we could all go and comment on this new policy, but does HHS have to respond to that? If they get overwhelmingly people saying that they don't want this, could they still go ahead and create this sort of gag rule?
They do actually have to respond to it. It's really interesting. I think actually in some ways the notice and comment period and administrative procedures are actually more responsive to public opinion than members of Congress would be, because members of Congress don't actually have to care what their constituents think. Right. Whereas they are actually required to address concerns raised through the notice and comment period, or else be kind of deemed as, or else they're kind of open to a lawsuit for passing a rule that is arbitrary and capricious.
Interesting. Interesting. Has there been any precedent in rules that have been commented on negatively and then they went ahead and did it anyway? Is there precedent for people saying, hey, this is capricious and you don't have the right to do this?
Yeah, there is. I don't know in the specific context if there is. I would be surprised if there is, because I don't think such a rule has been, they haven't attempted to pass it very often, but there is definitely precedent for there being litigation brought. And of course, there's always the challenge of standing, like who has standing to bring such a lawsuit. But to say basically that, you know, this rule is arbitrary and capricious because you didn't consider comments by kind of experts, or like there was an overwhelming amount of comments that were against this rule. And I think really it's kind of weird. The reason I think that people are not don't do as much activism in this space, although I think a lot of stuff gets done in this space, like through executive agencies and through rulemaking, is because most Americans don't know that it occurs.
No, it's so true.
It's a little bit frustrating.
Hard. It's kind of like, yes, there's this notice and comment period, but I feel like to find where I would be able to comment, I would need 3 Google searches and like an hour.
No, you don't actually. It's really easy. It's just it's federalregister.gov. Yeah, it's actually like, you know, for your member of Congress, they say they're not super responsive to like online stuff, right? Like for just like tweets or emails and stuff. But federalregister.gov, like notice and comment is all done online and it's very easy to do.
So is this kind of a gag rule? So threatening that to take funding away from providers that even discuss abortion in any way, is this in direct violation of Roe versus Wade?
No. Roe v. Wade says that you can't restrict a medical provider from providing an abortion or a woman from seeking an abortion. Federal funding to places that discuss or provide abortions is kind of a different issue. It's about appropriations. I think that it's kind of, the substance of the issue aside, it actually sets up, like, I think a really interesting legal fight, because appropriations are supposed to be the purview of Congress, the power of the purse is in Congress. So like there's that kind of separations of power issue, where maybe not for this Congress, but I could certainly imagine a Congress kind of pushing back and saying like, the executive should not have the right to say how we appropriate money. So I think like there's that kind of interesting legal issue. There's a free speech issue. And then there's also just an enforcement issue. Like if you go to any, like, I suppose it would be relatively easy to presume that, like, if you are a medical facility that provides abortions, then certainly, like, one could imagine that, like, this would kind of directly target those facilities, which is why people view this rule as a direct assault on Planned Parenthood. But if you're just, like, any medical facility, right, like, how the hell do you know what a doctor is saying to their patient anyway? Like, you have doctor-patient confidentiality, you have HIPAA, you have all these laws that protect the counsel a doctor is giving to their patient. So even internationally, when we talk about the global gag rule, it is just difficult to enforce. So it's almost, it to me feels quite symbolic. Like it's like you're trying to make a point as opposed to actually affect a change in a way. And I
feel a lot like the discussion we had when you were last on the show about, you know, people like Jeff Sessions making these statements that I, you know, they're not really trying to create policy. They're trying to feed their base and feed the political machine around them, not actually create policy. As you said, I mean, this issue of how do you even know what a doctor is talking to their patients about?
Yeah. And I think there's the added piece of it for this as well, which is that with this administration, like everything else to the side in terms of like or dislike of this administration, they don't always do what they say they're going to do. Like in the past presidents, when they make a statement like, I'm going to do this, they tend to do it. This administration does not fall into that category. And so I like could imagine that it's quite possible that they make an announcement that we're going to issue this rule and then they just never do it.
Right, right. That isn't, so just announcing that they're going to do it kind of whips up.
It gives them, like, they get the credit from their base that they have done it because they've made the announcement. But with this administration, we've seen it on more than one occasion that they've announced that they're going to do something and then not done it. And I've heard interesting foreign, like, I'm not a foreign policy expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I've heard interesting kind of conversation from foreign policy experts when they say, how do you think, you know, our foreign international leaders are starting to perceive the United States? And basically what they've said is like, you know, they now look at us like your word kind of doesn't mean anything. When you say you're going to do something, it doesn't mean you're actually going to do it. And we're just going to watch and see if you actually do it. So a good example is the tariffs that we were supposed to put on China, the steel tariffs. Remember, there was this whole hullabaloo about it. He said he was going to make exceptions for our allies. So that was obviously going to significantly water it down. But then it was announced today that he's going to wait on those on enforcing those tariffs for China. Right. And right. So, and like that obviously did not kind of get the kind of media attention and frenzy that the initial announcement got. So, you know, my guess is like for the vast majority of Americans, they think that that happened and it didn't happen.
Right.
And so like it's that kind of thing where it's like he announced that he was going to do this. So there was a whole hullabaloo. And I don't know that it actually happens even.
In your opinion, just from what you understand, do you think it's laziness or strategy or both?
I think it's totally strategy.
Yeah.
I think it's 100% strategy that like you like that he is extremely media savvy and understands that like you can win the argument in the press without actually ever having to do the thing. And the thing has actual, whether you're talking about tariffs or a gag rule, that the thing has actual consequences, but saying you did the thing, you don't have to deal with the consequences and you still get the credit for it.
So do you think that this is a policy that if this administration does actually follow through and put it forth and put it to notice and comment, do you think that this is a viable policy that will take hold, or do you think that this is more of an ideological, we just want to say this, but most people don't want it anyway, so it's not going to happen? I mean, do you think that there's like an actual understanding of that this is what people want?
I think that with abortion specifically, there's a big difference between what people say and what people believe. Like, as we've discussed previously, 1 in 3 women in the United States will have an abortion at some point in their lifetime. Like, it is not possible for them all to be Democrats. That's not how numbers work. That's not how numbers work. And also, like, kind of the stereotypical demonized version of the woman who's having the abortion is also like not reality. And so I think that there's like one, a lack of caring about ramifications of what a policy like this would mean. But I don't think that it's a thing of like, oh, our base really like wants this in terms of our base really wants the impacts of this. It's like our base really wants us to have like said, we do it, we've done it, which is like a different kind of thing.
Right, right. Well, thank you so much for helping us understand this. I know these sort of policies can get a little muddy and murky. Even me opening this and confusing the gag rule and the international gag rule, it's very complicated.
Yeah, totally.
So thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
When I first read this story, I actually had the gag rule as it's trying to be imposed mixed up with the global gag order. So the global gag order has to do with the funding and support aid, or, you know, financial aid that we send to other countries. And exactly. That aid cannot be used for abortion services or to counsel women in those countries on abortion services.
Yeah. And just like, yeah, exactly. And just like we have a Hyde Amendment for the states, there's also another amendment. I'm blanking on the name of it right now. It'll come to me. But there's a global amendment that prevents global funds from being used for abortions anyway. So it's our foreign aid funds. So the only reason this global gag rule is put into effect was to further limit what medical centers across the world could use money for and what they could even talk about. Yeah, they're trying to do that domestically as well.
Right. And so this new domestic gag rule really seems to put Planned Parenthood in its crosshairs.
Exactly.
And right. And Planned Parenthood serves 41% of women who receive federally funded family planning services. And I feel like I don't really need to say this to our listenership, but I feel like it needs to be out there in the ether. But family planning services is not some like extensive code for abortions. Family planning is everything from regular healthcare screenings, cancer screenings, breast exams, STI screenings, to all types of birth control, including the you know, what a lot of people like to tout is the like rhythm method or like all sorts of birth control, not just abortions, which I feel like there's this idea that all Planned Parenthood does is like do abortions 24/7, which is just not
exactly. And also, just for all the anti-choicers out there, I don't know if a lot listen to this podcast, but it's also about maternal health care too. So if you actually are pregnant and want to keep your baby or give it up for adoption or whatever, you can go to Planned Parenthood and get pregnancy care, prenatal vitamins. It's a healthcare clinic. And the only thing that what it means to defund Planned Parenthood is to cut Medicaid funding out of anything Planned Parenthood gets. And what this domestic gag rule basically does is if you even talk about abortion or if you provide abortion services in your clinic, not only can you not use federal services, but you can federal funding. You just can't get federal funding anyway. And the only way you can get federal funding is if you separate yourself from the clinics that do provide abortion, which is not like an on-off switch. You have to like physically change your locations, increase personnel. Like basically thousands of women depend on both types of services, the abortion services and the other types of services, or at the very least counseling about abortion. And so messing with the system is just going to fuck up everything. And it's going to screw over mainly women who use Planned Parenthood.
Right, right. And I mean, this all obviously always centers in on these intersections, poor women, women of color, you know, it basically, the more intersections you add to your identity, the more likely Planned Parenthood is going to be there to help you. And therefore, doing this really cuts down on options for women who are already not being serviced by
exactly
the government.
Yeah. As we know, like Planned Parenthood in rural areas is sometimes like the only clinic. And so if you like mess up that Planned Parenthood, it screws over, as you mentioned, poor people and women of color, but also what all the analysts have said about this potential legislation or, you know, legal rule is that it's going to create a two-tiered system for like women's healthcare. So rich women who can afford to go across state lines or like fly into California to get their certain type of care, they're going to get all the advice that they need. They're going to get truthful advice from their doctors, but doctors that are, you know, strangleholded by the Trump administration are not going to be able to tell poor women and women of color what they need to know about either abortion or just other kind of family planning.
Right. It's so frustrating because this is something I also spoke briefly with the DT. How is this enforceable? Right. And this goes back to something that we talked about last week about, you know, Jeff Sessions saying that they would separate mothers from their children if they were caught crossing the border illegally. And so it really feels like is there is less policymaking here, or less enforceable policymaking, and more feeding this political base and energizing Trump's base, especially in the run-up to this midterm election. Because to say that you can't get funding even if you counsel women on abortions, what are you going to do? Like, what, are you in the room with them? Like, and there's doctor-patient confidentiality and privacy agreement. So, like, what a doctor says to their patient is really should be considered a black box, right? Like, no one gets to know that.
There's HIPAA regulations, and then there's also doctor-patient confidentiality records and like regulations. So like a doctor can't just reveal what another patient's like medical care is supposed to be. So you're literally telling doctors, and you know, right-wing people love to talk about free speech. You're literally telling doctors, we don't want you to talk about your free speech, and we don't want you to do your job of doing no harm.
Exactly. Exactly. And it makes no sense to me, except when you put this political lens on it, because there's no way that this is an enforceable policy, right? I mean, all it would really do, I feel, and this is just me spitballing at this point, but I feel like all it would do would be to force Planned Parenthood to destroy all of their like abortion related literature, right? They can't hand you a pamphlet about abortion services. Okay, but that you can't stop doctors and nurses and healthcare providers from talking to their patients about all legitimate medical options.
Exactly.
And like it or not, assholes, abortions are still legal in this country before your second term, before the
exactly.
end of your second term. They
and
just are.
I mean, to the credit of Planned Parenthood, I mean, I think what they've said so far is that there is no way in hell we're going to stop providing abortions. It's literally the history of our organization is to provide abortions, legal, safe abortions. And so it's really basically just screwing over Planned Parenthood just so Trump can say promises made, promises kept. Because as you've probably noticed in the past couple of weeks, when it comes to China trade, Iran deal, North Korea, anything else, immigration, all Trump is saying is, hey, I kept a promise. I moved the embassy to Jerusalem. I'm going to get in a trade war with China. I'm keeping all these promises. It's not as if Trump actually cares about women or abortion or being anti-choice. He doesn't actually give
right.
a crap.
Right. He's not an ideologue. I mean, I would say that's the only thing Trump has going for him in this is that he doesn't actually care. He's
yeah.
just he's just checking shit off of some list.
Yeah.
Also interesting is that implementing a rule like this is actually subject to a notice and comment period. So HHS has to put out a call for comments basically on a rule like this before it can be implemented. And unlike Congress, they actually have to listen to what people have to say or they face lawsuits over creating rules that are arbitrary. So
yeah.
if a whole bunch of people go out there and say, no, HHS is not going to be able to do this kind of rule. I don't think they're actually even going to get that far. I don't think this is an actual policy they're actually trying to put on the table. I think they are trying to whip up frenzy around this issue ahead of the November midterms. But if it does come to that, there will be a comment period in which everyone I know and don't know and people I see on the street are going to get like a business card with the website to go do that. Because this is one of those things that can be stopped because this is one of those little known processes that is actually in place to protect arbitrary rules by the government.
Yeah, just like the net neutrality comment period, this is really important for everyone, like individuals to go out and do this, but also to make sure that you're lobbying people that in your healthcare community to do this as well, because mm-hmm. it's going to mean a lot coming from doctors. I'm sure there's already a bunch of doctors who have sent letters to the office to be like, this is bullshit. You can't do this. This is going to mess everything up.
Yeah. You know, I always think about, I got to meet Dr. Willie Parker, who is, he's a pretty well-known abortion doctor who specializes in abortion and women's healthcare. And he wrote a book called The Morality of, I'm going to get the title wrong. I don't want to say it, but basically, he argues that he is a very religious man. He's a very religious, spiritual man. And he believes that his first principle as a doctor is to do no harm and to do as much and to help his patients as much as he can. Doctors want to help their patients. Doctors do not want to not help their patients. I don't know how we can make this clearer. And to make it harder to do so goes against everything that many people that I know in the healthcare industry stand for.
Exactly. And even, even from a political standpoint, what's really rich about this like regulation is that Republicans usually rail against complicated regulations like this, unless you can use it to control women. Because this is like a really Kafka-esque, as you mentioned, really unenforceable policy, because no conservative in the past few decades has ever been able to prove without a doubt that Planned Parenthood is unlawfully using federal funds to provide abortions because the Hyde Amendment exists. But they still want to add more and more steps to this bureaucracy to make and to put as much bullshit as they can in the face of Planned Parenthood. And so it's just going to make it harder to serve women in every single community, rural, urban, anywhere, even in places that are, you know, really pro-choice. This could mess with states' rights and how they have dealt with abortions.
Oh, yeah. Oh, because Republicans are so states' rights until it has to do with my, like, uterus, in which case, like, nope.
Yep. At this time, I'm reminded of my favorite Rachel quote from The Friends, like, my uterus, like, my pain, I think. Or it's like, only my uterus can have an opinion. So, like, this is, it's such bullshit.
It is such bullshit. It is such bullshit. Okay, Varsha, let's move on. I want to talk about the school shooting that happened on Friday in Texas. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so basically this shooter, I don't really feel like saying his name, came into the high school. He had guns, I think, from his parents. And he came in and came into a classroom and started shooting people. And first, apparently he held surprise because that's really horrific. Then he shot, he killed 10 people and 13 people were injured. And he was a white young man. But also, as we will discuss, he had issues with women. And he first began his killing spree by killing his ex-girlfriend, or maybe a woman, maybe a girl who had refused him many times.
So I have been doing some research on a piece that I'm writing, a piece that I'm pitching about sort of the connection between domestic violence, gun violence, and what researchers have termed femicide. So female homicide specifically. And so I've been doing a lot of research, and I've been doing a lot of research on these sort of mass shootings and how they are often predicated on a history of some sort of domestic or violence towards women. And I've also been spending some time reading the incel like forums.
That sounds fun.
Oh, good Lord. So fun. So, because there's this prevalent, you know, there's been many, many inches, you know, and many, many columns on incels, especially recently after the Toronto terrorist attack, after the shooting in Isla Vista in 2014. And what the main theme is often, you know, yes, these young white men whom we won't call terrorists because they're white men, even though that's exactly what they are. You know, yeah, some of them are violent, but for the most part, it's just a whole bunch of lonely men who are, you know, angry, but also who understand, you know, who are really just looking for support. And I was like, okay, let's find out if that's right. Here's what I found is that every single thread I've read, every single post, regardless of the topic that it starts on, devolves into some form of violence or reference to one of these terrorists or like blatant misogynistic rhetoric in five posts in a thread or less.
I've read some of these, and one thing I've noticed is that they're always, or a couple of them that I've read, which is really horrific, is that they're always asking for other people's rape counts. So they're literally like planning on assaulting other women and bragging about it. And it's like, I don't know how much more violence and how much more terrorism you can get, because their policy or their vision, their political vision, their end goal of their terrorism is domestic violence, is violence against women. So it sucks that we can't call it terrorism, because there clearly is a history and a pattern of violence against women in all of these threads and in every single mass shooter that has happened over the past few years and over the past few decades, actually. You know, Think Progress had a piece, and they basically listed a bunch of them, and all of them had issues of domestic violence. And I think there's a thread by somebody on Twitter, and every single time there's a new one, every time there's a new shooting, she points to the fact that there's a history of domestic violence. But what's really scary is that they're all like collaborating on this incel issue. And people are sympathizing, maybe not sympathizing, but trying to argue that it's a legitimate viewpoint. And that's what's really scary.
Well, yeah. And then you get asshats like Ross Douthat. And I couldn't make up that name for him if I tried. But you get these ass clowns like Ross Douthat, who then are like, well, let's apply classic economic theory to and redistribute sex. And say, and then put the onus on women to have sex with these violent men to keep them from committing mass murders. And you know, just the nugget there is just so infuriating. But even just to start from that premise, even with the premise of let's apply classic economic theory to something like sex, you have to automatically assume that sex is a currency that is exchanged, that is it's an object, right? That you're exchanging an object for another object. That's how economics works. You're either bartering or you're giving someone money for a service or
so exactly.
So you've already decided that women are objects whose only purpose is to have sex with men to placate them so they don't commit acts of violence.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's so frustrating because Rothschild is obviously a conservative. And so, you know, communism and Marxism suck unless it's talking about sex and poor white men who can't get laid. But also, you know, this notion of sex as an object, he's also, if you're applying classical theory, not only are you having to exchange, there is a market. And so this notion that you can mess with the market as a conservative commentator is a little weird to me. And it doesn't make sense. And what I notice in all of these pieces, not just by Ross Douthat or other people, is like anytime they're talking about Jordan Peterson, they're trying to engage with it as if it's like a real idea or if he's a real intellectual. And he's not. What he's arguing for is that sex is a currency, but it's only a currency that men are owed. Women are not owed sex.
Oh, right. Exactly. There's no talk of redistribute, you know, making sure that women are having the sex that they want to have, right?
Yeah, and it's sexist on two different levels. One level because it's basically advocating for the control of women, and another level because it's saying that men and women have inherently different desires and men just cannot be controlled. But women, we have been socialized to be controlled and not really enjoy sex, so we should be more giving of it. And so it's just
exactly.
It's sexism exactly. All the way down, man.
Right. And you're right again. And another thing to on that vein that doesn't get talked about a lot though, is there's this idea that even when you propose something like a sexual marketplace, but for women, right? So let's distribute sex so that women are having sex with the men that they want to, and that all women are having sex. And on the face of it, that almost sounds funny to a lot of people that I've talked to, because they're like, oh, But women have all the sex they want, and they can have the sex they want to have, and they don't even want a market like that. And so just the assumption and the approach taken to this entire topic is so soul deadening. I sometimes don't even know where to start.
It's really frustrating also because, you know, places like the New York Times, which I understand, you know, that the piece, they had a recent profile of Jordan Peterson. I understand the piece was basically critical of him, but still giving that guy airtime that's what's messed up about this, because we're giving these people airtime. And it's really frustrating.
He even said, like, this guy, the media covers him relentlessly. I'm like, you are one of the media. Like, you are doing this. You are giving him this platform.
Basically, he had this quote, and I'm sorry to the listeners for reading this, but basically what he says about, you know, shooters is that he was angry at God because women were rejecting him. The cure for that is enforced monogamy. That's why monogamy actually emerges. Mr. Peterson does not pause when he says this. Enforced monogamy to him is simply a rational solution. And then the author says, she laughed. And then the guy says, really creepily, Peterson says, you're laughing about them, and that's because you're female. The interview should have ended there. She should have just said, this man is a sexist pig.
Bye.
I'm not going to interview him. Bye.
Bye.
it should be very clear. And obviously what she, or maybe not she, or what the New York Times editor should notice is that this is not a discussion that's helping women understand sexism, because they already know this kind of crap exists. It's just encouraging, it's giving men another screen, another place to read about this kind of misogyny. And I understand that, you know, that we need to know about Jordan Peterson because he's influencing a lot of young men through his YouTube videos. But there has to be a better way to do it than giving him airtime where he can spew his bullshit.
Oh, absolutely. And even in that piece too, in that particular, because he's, you know, he talks about enforced monogamy, which I'm like, okay. But it flies directly in the face of the other tenets of his, let's call it, belief system, where, you know, he believes in basically, you know, an open market. And I think he even acknowledges in this piece those two things that he believes are completely contrary to one another. And he's like, yeah, well, it works for everything except monogamy because, you know, white men need sex. I mean, he literally says that in that piece. And so the fact that that was even kept in, and the fact that that wasn't the thesis of that entire profile, was odd to me, because it's so, I mean, because it just, all it does is create this moment in which we give this guy, the New York Times' audience, and and maybe someone who didn't think that way, but who reads the New York Times because they're a very cultured person, you know, reads this profile and is all of a sudden like, oh, this kind of makes, oh yeah, this guy.
Yeah. Like, can I give you another example of how they interviewed Jordan Peterson? So Vox has a podcast called Today Explained, and this guy called Sean Ramaswamy hosts it, and he's really great, right? And they bring on this reporter who's been covering Jordan Peterson, and they talk about how weird he is and how crazy he is in terms of his sexism and how he talks and how he's trying to encourage young men to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but also, you know, get laid. But then, you know, they actually interview him. He calls him and he starts debating him, right? And the thing is, at the end of that debate, he says, you know, obviously I didn't get, neither of us agreed on anything, but it was an important conversation to have. And I'm just like, why was it an important conversation to have? Because you know what Jordan Peterson said during that interview? All he said was, Justin Trudeau was wrong for trying to hire 50% women in his cabinet. That's bullshit. There is no history of oppression for women. You know, there were many female queens of their countries. And I was just like, this is such inane bullshit. And this notion that he deserves to be heard is crap. That's not what free speech is. And there was a really great article a long time ago or a while ago by Jennifer Wright. And she, I think it was in Harper's, and she talks about, or maybe it was in The Verge, but basically she talks about, like, we're all complicit in this kind of perpetuation because we're veiling it under free speech. We're veiling this incel revolution under the notion that, oh, it's the internet. We have to let them talk, even though it's reprehensible and disgusting. And I'm like, yes, we have to let them talk, but the media has a responsibility to understand what is talk and what should be heard and what is newsworthy and what is harmful and what is dangerous.
And you absolutely have the right. Jordan Peterson has the right to sit in his weird man cave that they describe in like very tender detail in this piece, which was weird to me. But he has the right to sit there and think and say and do whatever the fuck he wants, right? You don't need to give him the New York Times readership because of free speech, right? Like, just because this person has the right to say and think these things does not mean they have a right to an audience. And when you give him one, under the theory that you know, we shouldn't be stifling people's free speech, you're not. By not talking to him, you are not stifling his free speech, period.
Yeah. And also this notion that sunlight is the best disinfectant, that's bullshit. In this internet age, that's bullshit. Sunlight is actually a really great way to get really famous and encourage more people to become misogynist pieces of crap. Yeah. And I think my favorite quote, and it was the Verge piece, but it was by Laura Hudson, not by Jennifer Wright. But Laura Hudson had this tweet and she's like, misogyny isn't a red flag to a lot of people. It's water. You know, for women, misogyny is literally the water we are swimming in and we are all going to drown if we continue to give platforms to people like Jordan Peterson.
I really like the way that was put, misogyny is water that we're all swimming in. And it also isn't something that you just jump into when you're older. Like, these are issues that you start understanding as a woman when you're young, when you're a teenager. And we're talking about these school shootings and school violence. And Teen Vogue had this great article about violence in teen relationships, because we don't like to talk about it. But, you know, when you talk about domestic violence and school shootings in the same breath, you're talking about children hurting each other. And that's really hard. Like, that's a really difficult thing to internalize as a person, because most people are completely, you know, not horrible people. But, you know, so this article said that 1 in 3 adolescents experience verbal, emotional, sexual, or physical abuse from a dating partner. And over 1.5 million high school students suffer physical abuse from an intimate partner every year. And additionally, women ages 16 to 24 experience dating violence at rates 3 times higher than the national average. And roughly 43% of LGBTQ adolescents experience physical dating violence. What? I mean, you have to you have to think that scale. We're talking about children who are already experiencing intimate partner violence. And we can't have this conversation about domestic violence leading to mass murders and mass shootings at schools without talking about that piece.
Exactly. It's so important to understand that this stuff, you know, toxic masculinity, misogyny, is not something that just appears on your 18th birthday or something that just appears on, you know, with the election of Donald Trump. It has been going on for decades and it begins young. And there was like this great, I mean, on a happier note, there was this really great tweet I saw where this woman was watching Sleeping Beauty with her like 4-year-old son. And at the end, the prince like kisses Sleeping Beauty, right? And the boy was like, oh my God, he just kissed her. And the mother is like, yeah, I mean, she has to wake up. He's like, no, he can't just kiss her. He has to ask first. And it was, it's the cutest tweet I have read all week, but it's also just key to understanding what, you know, women and men who are raising young boys should be doing from childhood is trying to talk about not just consent, but relationships, about, you know, what it means to be a boy, what it means to be a girl, and just in general, what it means to be a human being and a part of it's like a civil society. And I think what's really frustrating about teen, you know, dating violence is that I don't, at least my parents just did not want to talk about dating at all. And I know most parents just don't. And so you are going through this yourself. You're dealing with peer pressure in high school. And, you know, what's really tragic about this is the most recent shooting is the mother of the girl who died. You know, the daughter told her mom about all of this. And, the, you know, the mother said on TV, like, she just kept refusing him. But, you know, and then she finally stood up to him. And then like 2 weeks later, he goes on this murder spree. And so we just have to really understand not just telling men how to ask for consent, but also telling men how to deal with rejection. Because if you don't tell men how to, or young boys how to deal with rejection, they're going to turn into shooters, or they're going to turn into people like Jordan Peterson who think they're entitled to everything.
And to the point of, you know, people don't want to talk about teens dating, and don't want to talk about kids dating. And it's almost always framed as like abstinence only versus comprehensive sexual education, right? So it's kind of framed in this sex, like, should teens be having sex? Yes or no? Like, should we be talking about it? Yes or no? But dating and relationships at that age are way more than just sex. I mean, sometimes, you know, often when you're dating in high school, you don't even have sex with the person, right? You're just dating them. And, yeah. And the relationship is what needs to be talked about. And I think when you're older, when you're in college or out of college and you're in an abusive relationship, there's this understanding that you talk to your friends about it, you talk to your parents about it, you can get help. But for teens who aren't quote unquote supposed to be dating, or a lot of things are written off as puppy love, right? Mm-hmm. And people don't take it as seriously. I think that's also key, is we have to reshape the culture so that girls experiencing intimate partner abuse and violence have somewhere to go. And it's not something that we reject out of hand or write off as puppy love, or, you know, like in middle school when boys used to snap your bra straps, like, that's abuse. And we need to talk about it as such.
Exactly. And, you know, this also ties into the discussion we just had about abortion, because the Trump administration is not just, you know, curtailing abortion. They also curtailed a study that was already fully funded about how to stop unplanned pregnancies or teen pregnancies. They also stopped, you know, plans to increase contraception. They also are increasing abstinence-only education, as you mentioned, in schools. So they are exacerbating this problem. And I agree that the problem has already been bad for probably years in high school because of how, you know, how teens have to deal with these issues, but nobody is really helping. And it's not helping that, you know, men are, you know, young boys feel like they're entitled to sex by people like Jordan Peterson, and that men feel that acceptable behavior mirrored by the president, our sexual predator in chief, is acceptable. So there's so many factors to this. And obviously one of the main factors is this whole incel revolution online. You know, but underneath all of it is just a hatred of women. And we have to start discussing it, because it's not just about gun control. You know, all these Republicans, like just today, Oliver North, the new head of the NRA, was like, Ritalin, ADHD medication, causes school shootings. Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? Fine. You want to find an external explanation for mass shooters? Don't use bullshit explanations like Ritalin or the number of doors in a school or mental health, because, you know, mentally ill people don't shoot up places. You know, people who are ADHD don't shoot up schools. And, you know, schools are still going to get shot up even if there's one door. You should talk about the real cause. And the root cause of this is domestic violence, or is a hatred of women. And so
you want to externalize this? Like, let's talk about the actual things that are causing it. You don't want to talk about guns? You're fucking awful. Like, we didn't talk about guns, but you want to pick something else? Fine. Domestic violence, incels, Jordan Peterson.
Yeah. And what's really, really the icing on the cake is even when gun rights activists talk about women's issues, people like Dana Loesch, they switch it into how women should be defending themselves. and like, you know, women on college campuses, they should get guns because they should defend themselves against men. Not, hey, let's maybe talk about how men shouldn't rape women. Maybe that's a good way to,
don't rape women. Conversation over.
It's not that hard. And it's really frustrating that on every single level of this, when it comes to family planning, you know, abortion, gun violence, domestic violence, the onus is on women. And so obviously the theme of today is women have to bear everything and we're sick of it. So Devin, what are you grateful for this week?
I as I said at the top of the show, I go to this gym called Nerd Strong, and we're very on brand. And there's a subgroup in the gym. We have a Facebook group, and we plan events together, and it's called the Valkyries of Nerd Strong, and it's all the women who go to Nerd Strong. And we have done some really fun things. We set up like a burlesque class that we all took. We've done like fancy lady at night out. We all go out, and so one of the coaches at the gym is a professional stunt and fight like choreographer. She choreographs fights for movies and TV shows. And so they are putting on a 2-day like female empowerment workout party, basically. And long story short is I get to play with swords for 2 days. It's in a couple of weekends and I'm really excited about it. I'm so excited. I'm going to learn how to, so we're going to like learn how to choreograph our own fights and like work with like props, weapons, and like axes. And we're going to like throw shit. I'm really excited about it. Just fun things. And it's just it's so cool to see women. And at this gym that we go to, it really does focus on creating a safe space for everyone. You know, there's this idea like with gym culture that can get very clicky and bro-y and they actively work against that. And it's so nice to be in these spaces that go out of their way to make it a safe environment for everyone, and especially keep an eye out on taking care of the women who work out in a CrossFit gym, which is not exactly the most female-friendly space on the planet. So I'm just very grateful for that.
That's awesome. Well,
so yeah, what about you?
I am grateful for two things. One thing is personal. As you guys all know, I'm like a history major or a history PhD student. So I was at the Reagan Library this whole week, and I will be all of next week. And I'm really grateful for all of the amazing documents there, but also the archivist who is there, the head archivist who is in charge of like helping me find my documents. He sort of gave me like a roundabout way to find everything I need. And the website doesn't really have a way to do a keyword search for every single thing that has to do with India and US relations. And he was like, oh, don't worry, I can do that. And he gives me like this 10-page list of every single thing in the whole library. And I request all of it. And it is amazing. And then, you know, next week he's going to give me more and more lists. And so archivists are some of the nicest people on this planet. So I'm grateful for my archivist, Ray. And that's another amazing thing I'm grateful for. I know. It's just like, you know, a lot of people think historians, all they do is just like, you know, sit in a room and like talk about history or yell facts at students. But it's a lot of hard work, and archivists make it a lot easier because it's not just like Google searching everything. You also have to have like an organization to it. And so it's amazing. And
I just now have a vision of you sitting in a room yelling facts at students.
Yes.
Like this is the future liberals want.
This is actually my dream job. And next fall, I actually get to teach U.S. history both semesters. So I'm going to start with you know, pre U.S. independence and go until the end of Civil War. And then next spring, I'm starting Reconstruction to the Present. And it's going to be so much fun because one of my professors actually told me since Donald Trump was elected, people have actually been more engaged in class because they really want to understand where we came from and how we got here. So anytime the professor, you know, brings up Teapot Dome or the Nixon Watergate scandals, Iran-Contra, or scandals before the Civil War, the scandal of Reconstruction, Andrew Johnson's impeachment, everyone gets apparently really excited. So I am very, very excited to teach this fall. I basically get to like run a section of like 20 students and two sections of 20 students. So I'll be able to like read their papers, really discuss history. What's really cool is that we're going to read Democracy in America by Tocqueville, and that's one of my favorites. So I'm very excited to teach. And so that's why I'm thankful for, you know, Ray the Archivist. But I'm also thankful for Robert Mueller. It was his 1 year anniversary on May 17th. So congratulations. Aww. And what's really great is, like, even Donald Trump said, congratulations. Aww. We are now in the second year of the greatest witch hunt in American history. And the reason it's a great witch hunt is because a lot of witches have been caught. And I remember, this time last year, I was really frustrated because every single day I would go into work, I was working a different job, and I would just check the news all day. And it was just very depressing. Right. And then I remember, you know, when Comey got fired, everybody was like very on their toes. Right. But I was still like, you know, underwhelmed by the Comey firing. Cause I was like, this is like, you know, nothing big has happened. Also, Comey was a jackass. Who gives a crap? Right. But May 17th. Yeah. May 17th. Right. I get the push notification.
I was like, good.
That,
bye.
You know, Robert Mueller has been appointed by Rod Rosenstein as a special counsel. And I literally go around the office telling every single person what this means and what I've just read. And everyone is, you know, a few people are excited, but most people who are like sort of tech San Francisco people are like, okay, should you go back to work now? And I'm like, yeah, but you know, you don't understand. Robert Mueller is, you know, it's not like he's a Democrat, or it's not like he's Jim Comey. He's like the Republican Superman, right, of the FBI. Right. Yeah, he's so dedicated to Republicanism that he's stayed out of partisan squabbles for the past like few decades, I think, or at least 2 decades, because he's been in public service in the FBI. So he is
right.
Yeah, and the thing is, a lot of like conservatives or even like smug Democrats are like, "Oh, yeah, we can't rely on Robert Mueller to save us." I'm like, I'm not saying Robert Mueller's going to save me. I'm just saying watching him work, watching all this shit leak out. Remember that day where all those indictments came down? Like, watching that makes me want to work harder. So that's why I'm thankful for Robert Mueller's 1 year.
Really though, what is the tradition? Like, what do you get for your 1 year anniversary with like one of the most important people in your life? Like, what would I get him?
Yeah, I think the 1 year anniversary is, isn't it paper? Is it paper? I don't forget.
It's paper. Does that mean more indictments? Does that mean that he's going to get me more indictments? Because of our long-term relationship now.
I really hope so. I also think we are truly committed because Rudy Giuliani tried to break us up by being like, oh, Robert Mueller is going to be over by September 1st. And then it came out a couple hours later that he totally made that whole shit up just to piss off people.
Nothing can get between us, not even Rudy. All right, Varsha, it is time for the dickwad of the week. That was fun. So Varsha, we have a repeat offender this week. Would you like the dishonor of naming the dickwad of this week?
I am. I'm very excited to name the dickwad of this week. It's someone that we all know and have loved to hate, President Donald John Trump. He's done something, you know, dick watery every single day for the past 3.5 years.
I mean, just assume that he gets it like default, right? It's every week the dick wad is Donald Trump. But this week was so disgusting that we there was no one that could even come close.
It was peak Donald Trump. It was the kind of Donald Trump that SNL can't make up. It was, yeah. And it was just so frustrating. And I'm sure everybody knows what we're talking about. But last week he was in this like town hall or, you know, round table with a bunch of sheriffs. And he called, you know, in response to this one sheriff complaining about a gang member who she couldn't really charge because, you know, even though people knew he was a gang member, she couldn't charge him. And he responded by saying, oh, they're animals. And he started like going on this tirade about immigrants. But the thing is, people couldn't realize whether it was he was talking about MS-13 or immigrants in general. And so the whole media decided to have like a 2-day like circle jerk about whether or not Donald Trump was offensive and racist. I think we've decided that Donald Trump is offensive and racist.
Spoiler alert.
The day he ran his campaign. Yeah, like spoiler alert, Donald Trump is a racist.
Yeah. Yeah. So he called, it's not clear if it was MS-13 members or immigrants, and he called them animals. And, you know, he said, quote, I refer to them as animals. And guess what? I always will. And the thing is like, let's even say for the purpose of this conversation that he was referring to MS-13 gang members. First of all, that's not better. Like, I don't care who you're talking about. You don't call people. It's just not done. That's first of all. And second of all, this is not the first time that he has said hateful things towards people of color. So shithole countries, anyone remember that mini scandal? Or Mexicans are rapists, anyone remember that mini scandal that launched this whole fucking nightmare that we're in right now?
Yeah, and he's been doing this for like decades. I think a long time ago he was like, I have Jewish people count my money, not black people. So what the hell was up with that?
Exactly. And so whether or not he was talking about MS-13 or immigrants specifically, who he was talking about were people of color, period, full stop. He was referring to them as animals. And he has been doing it for, like you said, decades. This is not the first time. This is not the second time. This is not the first time this year he's done it. But the fact of the matter is calling, using this sort of language, calling people animals, and is creating a sense that when you use language like that, you're doing something very specific. You are dehumanizing people. Aditi and I talked about this on Monday a lot, about how so much of this administration, how so much of an autocracy or other totalitarian regimes are about dehumanizing people. Because in order to control someone, in order to put yourself above them, you have to dehumanize them first. And so if the first couple of steps are done for you, if the president of the fucking United States is already dehumanizing these people for you, it takes a lot less for you to take that last leap and fully do it yourselves. And I think that this, I think it even goes back to what we were talking about before, and this quote that misogyny is the water that women swim in. The basic dehumanization of self is the water that people of color, and in this particular example, immigrants, swim in. This is the water that they swim in. And just because you're blatantly saying it out loud, that doesn't make that less true. It just means that we now have a leader that is not just okay with this sort of characterization and okay with the doubling down on this. He is actively trying to dehumanize people who live in this country. And
the thing is, when we allow him, sorry to interrupt, but like when we allow him to say that he was just talking about MS-13, when that media allows him, concedes him that point, he gets an inch, and that inch is that ambiguity, because in the record, the transcript, it's ambiguous whether he's talking about immigrants as a group, Mexicans as a group, or just MS-13, right? And that translates not just as a buzzword, like dehumanization is like, oh, we're this liberals engaging in this sophistry about whether or not you should dehumanize criminals. It's not just sophistry. It translates into actual policy, because as we know, ICE is not just deporting gang members. It has been deporting people who are just have never committed crimes ever. And I looked at the stats, and basically since January 20th, 2017 to the end of 2017, ICE arrested 45,436 immigrants without criminal records. Did all those people just like shoplift ones? Like, why did you arrest them? Why did you detain them? Why did you deport them? I don't understand, right? And then showing that in the first 3 months of 2018, there's an additional 13,000 immigrants without criminal records that are arrested. And so the thing is, it translates into policy. And also, language is important. And, you know, at Devin and Sarah, you guys have made this a theme of the podcast since the beginning, but it matters what the president says and does. And by doing, you know, we're referring to his sexual assault allegations, and by saying, we're referring to the racist crap that comes out of his mouth every day. And so, you know, this percolates into like our culture. And so just over the past few weeks, you've been hearing all of these stories about white men and women calling the cops on black people. But also a pattern we have seen since January 2017 and before is people threatening undocumented people, or people they think are undocumented, or people who look foreign, to call ICE. And, you know, you probably saw the video of that Manhattan lawyer who threatened to call ICE on people for speaking Spanish in New York fucking city. It was New York. People speak all kinds of languages in New York. And then also, I just read this, and it's so horrifying, but a Customs and Border Patrol official detained two U.S. citizens because they spoke Spanish in a gas station in Montana. So as you were saying, like, this kind of language, dehumanized language, is not just important because he's saying it and because he's the president and he should be better than that, but it's important because it's creating this notion of what's acceptable. And this kind of violence, because this kind of violence against MS-13 in terms of violent language is acceptable, then this kind of violence against people we think are foreign and we don't know whether they're criminal or not is acceptable. Basically, it's like, it's a system. It's a system as old as time. And like a lot of historians on Twitter pointed it out that every time before ethnic cleansings, and I want to be frank about it. What's happening with ICE is an ethnic cleansing. Obviously, we're not murdering millions of people, but they are cleansing them out of this country because they think they don't belong. And before other ethnic cleansings happen in Uganda, in Germany, they've used derogatory words to refer to minority groups of people.
Because they start the dehumanization process. If you have to start it early because it takes a long time to get to the point where you don't exactly see human as a human. And so you have to start on this sort of this sort of like larger rhetorical scale. And I also, what you pointed out, that the transcripts were ambiguous. And the fact that the ambiguity was even there, the fact that it was ambiguous for if he was talking about MS-13 or Mexicans or immigrants in general, the fact of the matter is just the presence of that ambiguity lets you know that Trump has already lumped all of those people into that category together.
Exactly.
Call them all animals either way, right? It's like, it's
exactly
one half dozen of another, right? Like whether or not he had already lumped them all together, it was so unclear that it doesn't even fucking matter. Like,
doesn't even fucking matter. And it's as if conservatives and certain media commentators are treating it like a draw, and the draw goes to the winner, which is Trump, meaning he wasn't racist. But no, it's not a draw. Right. The thing is, you have to count this as like a fucking pattern. It's been 3 years of him saying stuff and then going back on it. Like, remember Khizr Khan, and he gave the speech, and then he said, Trump said in an interview, why didn't the mother talk? Maybe she wasn't allowed to talk. Everybody in America heard that fucking dog whistle, mm-hmm. right? And so this notion that this is something new, and this amnesia that everybody in the country has every time he says something newly racist, we forget everything he said before. That's what's really frustrating, because the lack of clarity is the mechanism that he is using to right. target immigrants.
Exactly.
He is depending on us not being able to discern that he is racist. He's depending on us to continue saying, oh, we don't know what's really in his heart, so he can continue being racist. Yeah. And what's really frustrating is that, you know, I don't read German really well, but I read it pretty well.
Of course you do. Who reads German pretty well? What?
I'm not great. I'm teaching. I'm self-taught, right? So I'm reading because I want to pass a language exam. And so I try to read either the English version or the German version of Der Spiegel, like every week. And I never get to finish all of it, but I definitely at least look at the cover story and at least the cover, because it's like the German New Yorker, and they caught on to the racism from day fucking one.
Right.
You know that whole time period where he said those people were very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville? Like, that Ku Klux Klan cover was on Der Spiegel way before it was on the New Yorker.
Right.
And so other countries with histories of racist strongmen, or at the very least like racist leaders, are able to discern this, and they're not falling for this bullshit of we don't know what's in its heart, it was ambiguous. But the thing is, we still are. And I have to say, like, I want to say it's because, not because like all of us are inherently racist, I think it's because all of us haven't been able to deal with this, or haven't had to deal with this for decades. It's not like we were all born, you know, in the 1910s when Wilson was president, right. and we had like an openly racist president.
Right.
Right.
It's been a minute since we've had someone so openly racist. That's not to say they haven't been racist, but it hasn't been like this. We don't really know what to do with ourselves, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. And we don't know how to comment on it, because as we probably know, we've been reading these new like stories for the past year, and every single time it's racially charged or inaccurate or a falsehood. It's never a lie. It's
right.
never racist.
Right.
It's always and soon it's being applied to not just people like the president, but now people who are just day old, like everyday racists, like Joe Arpaio gets the credential of a racially charged comment, and it's
benefit
like
of the
call
doubt.
It what it is. Say what you mean. And just like, you know, dealing with Jordan Peterson and the incels and how the media isn't saying what it means and saying the truth, or at least being very frank with the violence that's going on, they're not being very frank with the violence that's going on with this kind of rhetoric. It's totalitarian rhetoric. And it's really important. It's not sophistry. We're not bleeding heart liberals complaining about a word, and we're not defending MS-13.
No, but for me, it shouldn't even matter. The fact that that is acceptable for the president of the United States to call anyone that, regardless. This is just not how you are. That's not how you human, right? And my issue is that you put so beautifully, Varsha. I mean, you captured it so perfectly. It matters. And it also matters because at the end of the day, like, we as a country, our moral heart needs to be saved at the end of this. And I'm worried about that, because at some point something will happen. And I hope that it ends with Trump in office or in jail would be preferable. But I need our moral heart to continue, and we need to be able to rebuild it. And every time he says something like this, it chips it away just a little bit.
Yeah, it's like, and I don't want to lessen, you know, what this actually feels like to every, you know, individual people, but it's like emotional abuse. It's like living in a house and you can't escape, and the person you're living with is constantly emotionally abusing you and ruining your character and gaslighting you. And I think what's like, you know, I remember like Sean Spicer recently made a tweet about this crowd that was like really big. And he tweeted, "I concur, this is the largest crowd." And I was like, "Ha ha, that's funny, because you've been gaslighting us for every single like day that you were press secretary." And that's what they're doing with this kind of language. They get to say, "No, you're the ones who are stupid. You're the ones who are defending MS-13. And it's the same thing with, I know you're going to talk about this on Thursday, or you might get to talk about it, but it's the same thing with what was happened at the protests in Gaza. You know, they flipped the narrative on us and said, "Oh, we're defending Hamas." I don't think any American Jewish commentator who supports Palestine, or anybody who supports remote Palestine in the U.S., was supporting Hamas. We were supporting the fact that, right? And so that's what's frustrating about this, is that, you know, he gets to use this comment and use the ambiguity to say that we're the ones who are wrong, even though we can see with our eyes. So, you know, that initial policy that we talked about, the domestic gag rule, that's Kafka-esque in the sense that it's bullshit and we don't know why it's being done and it's confusing. This kind of rhetoric is Orwellian. So we've had two types of dystopian novel references today. It's just, it's a grab bag of dystopia today. It's just so much. You can't, because there's so much you can apply to this. You can apply Kafka to this. You can apply Orwell. You can apply J.K. Rowling. You can apply The Hunger Games. It's just, it's all there.
All right, Varsha, last but not least, let's do a few action items. So something Hellions can do after they listen to the show. So first off, I am urging everyone right now to get out your cell phone or smartphone or whatever. Look up who your member of Congress is. Look up who your senator is. I'm sure all of you Hellions already know and have them on speed dial. Call them. Tell them that gun control, it is now too late to start talking about it. Something needs to happen right fucking now. We need to take them to task. This is the 16th mass shooting in 2018, and we're talking about children. And it's done. It's done. We're over.
Yeah. And I no longer want to hear this crap from conservatives about how it's, you know, mass shootings are pretty rare or all that crap. Just tell your congressman and like senator, keep bothering them, because at some point, you know, we're going to have a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress again. And you want to show that new Congress in 2018 and hopefully that new president in 2020 that we care about gun control, right? And so support.
Top of list.
Yeah. Yeah. Support people like Everytown, March for Our Lives, and Moms Demand, especially Moms Demand, because we support women on this podcast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Donate to Planned Parenthood. Obviously, a lot of shit is going on with this ridiculous domestic gag rule and this attack, frankly, on Planned Parenthood. And right now, I think the best thing that we can do for Planned Parenthood is to show them that we still support them. And no matter what happens with federal funding, no matter what fucking shit this administration tries to throw at them, we believe in Planned Parenthood and we believe in their mission. And so donate what you can to Planned Parenthood. And as always, bonus points if you do it in the name of Mike Pence or another anti-choice man of your choice. Like I said, it cleanses my soul to donate to Planned Parenthood every month in loving memory of Mike Pence. So I'm petty. It helps me sleep at night.
Totally. And then The last action item, as everyone hopefully already knows in California, is you should register to vote. You should be already registered to vote because today is Monday, May 21st, and the elections, the primaries are on June 5th. So vote for whoever you want, but we obviously need every single Democrat possible voting in the primaries because some of these House districts, they have multiple Democrats running, and we want to make sure because of the primary system in California that we don't end up with two Republicans gaining the most number of votes because all the Democrats, you know, cannibalize each other. So make sure you get out to vote in the primary, make sure to get your friends registered, do everything you can to vote. And the best part about registering, if you registered early, is I got my ballot in the mail. I just have to put it in the mailbox tomorrow. Okay, great. And then final action item, Hellions. In honor of my first time co-hosting, I would like everyone to obviously subscribe and rate and review the podcast, but also get one person to listen to the podcast and convince them to subscribe. And hopefully they can join the fun on Dickwads Be Gone, the Facebook group.
Yes, we do have a lot of fun there. Well, Varsha, thank you so much. This was so great. It was so great to talk to you. And honestly, I still can't believe that you can read German. What is this? Are you trying, like, come on.
Again, I'm not great. I'm not great.
All right. Well, thank you, Hellion, so much for listening. I will be back here on Thursday with some very special guests. So raise some hell. Remember to be kind. And I will see you on Thursday.